competitors of a kind, you know, with the quadruples?
No. No. I might say with Yuthi, I was asked by EAI to be director, and I wanted him to be co-director, and they didn't want to do that. Mm. And so he said, that's fine, he would be associate director of the operation. And when he showed, you know, uneasiness with this setup, I said, well, why don't you be director and I'll work for you? Then I said, I don't have any problems with that. I said, really, I really meant it. And it was not acceptable to EAI.
Hmm.
They didn't, you know, it was too far out, I guess you'd
right,
say.
From their conservative from their,
right.
mode.
And so, I would just say, I think, I don't know the reasons, all the reasons. They're just, I'm sure there are a lot of things that that are hard to discern, for me at least. But we had a good relationship really right up to the last day, as far as I was concerned. And I don't guess it was maybe quite the same as far as he was concerned.
Mm.
I think he probably, he wanted to do his own thing.
Right.
And I respect him for that.
And was he eventually, with UTI, was that a successful concern, or?
I would say no.
Mm.
The two people he took with him became absolute enemies,
mm.
Brainin and Warren Wright, and they had to put a wall down the middle of the company and one of them on each side of it. And I mean, literally. And they made power supplies for the semiconductor industry as their first product, and maybe 3 years later made quadrupoles to go with, to be used in the semiconductor industry.
Right.
And in fact, I think it was sometime in the mid-80s that Mike came and wanted to sell the company to us.
Hmm.
And UTI didn't ever go public, and whereas, you know, we went public within about 4 years of,
right.
of when we started, 4 to 5. They had financial problems, and they wound up selling a large part of the company to a gas, I've forgotten the name of the company, to one of the companies that produced gas. Oxygen.
Hydrogen. Like an air product.
Air products is the name of it, yeah.
Oh, okay.
I think it was. And, but they didn't do very well,
mm.
and they probably grew to $5 million or something like that over 20 years or something of that order. And I think built a good product, but it was not a very big market.
Right.
And so they wound up, Mike died an early death in his 50s, and right maybe at the time we met, when he was interested in selling UTI to Finnegan in late 80s, I guess it was, he had pancreatic cancer.
Oh.
And so he died shortly after. And I don't know if he ever got any money out of it or not.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't know. It was at that point of just no interest at all to us because we were in a different business.
Right. And what was the fate of the EAI division, just briefly, how did that play out?
Well, after I left,
right.
Things, I would say they continued making RGAs, selling them through Altec.
Mm-hmm.
The company tried to sell it to Hewlett-Packard. And once HP realized I was gone, they expressed zero interest.
Wow.
They just said they wouldn't consider buying it without, I'd say, myself. And they didn't know Mike's story, but, you know, they felt probably
yeah.
the key people had gone with me. And Hewlett and Packard themselves ran the product as soon as it was delivered to F&M.
Hmm.
They appeared there, like, the following week, and each of them was involved. They spent a good part of a day running it, and it certainly influenced their own entry into mass spectrometry. And So EAI tried to sell it to Varian,
mm-hmm.
and Varian looked at it for a while, and then they changed from, by that time, Altec was part of PerkinElmer.
Oh.
And then EAI decided to sell the product through Varian and do the OEMing that we had done through Altec through Varian. And I think that worked okay for a while, but over a period, they tried to build the Quad 300 that we had and delivered one to Klaus Biemann at mm-hmm. MIT, which was a pretty big failure. But anything besides magnetic would have been a failure. And so they wound up maybe going on for about 5 years, and then they decided to move the operation from here to Houston. And I don't know exactly why, and I don't remember. And at that point, I had enough problems of my own. But it closed down. And Gordon mm-hmm. Nelson went off to do other things. Bill, whom I had
right.
Suggested to replace me. And so, and EAI as a company became a huge disaster. Mm-hmm. And really, I would say, you know, lost the only thing they had, the lead in analog computers. Analog computers became sort of like buggy whips. and they tried to make the change to digital through the hybrid door.
Right.
But it never panned out, and EAI has become an obscure company that does service. I think the only thing they do is provide service to other companies in manufacturing and maybe in field service of products. And so mm-hmm. it became relative, I'd say within maybe 10 years of when I last was there, it became a company in deep trouble. And so I don't think I left any enemies at this part of EAI, and I hope not with the mother company, but because we went after the GCMS market, which they had openly turned down
right.
and said they not only had no interest in it, they basically forbade me to pursue it. And that became our major market area.
So in setting up the Finnegan Corporation, you were working with Sant on financing and Chu, who was at Varian managing chromatography,
right.
GC?
He was at the head of the GC division,
okay.
Aircraft, they called it.
Right, Aircraft. Yeah. And he was an investor, and he
right.
was he sort of advising then about the chromatography side of things?
No.
I
would say, I wrote a business plan, and it was on yellow paper, and I was going to get it typed, but I didn't start writing until I left EAI. I really didn't do anything in that direction because I didn't feel right doing it. And so I wrote it on yellow pad paper, a whole outline of our business, and I went through it with Roger Sant, and brought up his own numbers. Figured them out from there, and how much money we would need, and this and that, and so Roger is a very, very bright person. He is a billionaire today, and he's on the Forbes 400. He's
wow.
number 99, I think. And Roger, I recognized him as a very bright person. He was not a billionaire then, and he had made a little money on Aircraft. And he had a good job at Syntex. He was very respected by Zaffaroni, especially,
mm-hmm.
who's still a close friend of his, and I would say still a good friend of mine too. And so Roger had been the person who had financed Aircraft with working with TZ, and had really talked Keen Dimmick, the founder,
mm-hmm.
into using loans rather than selling equity.
Mm-hmm.
And Keen wound up, you know, maybe taking a large amount of money, $20 million or something, out of, which is a lot of money back then, out of Airgraph, and he was the principal owner of Airgraph. And Wilkins Research, they called it.
Mm-hmm.
And but Roger was the financial whiz, and he had worked, I think, for Dean Witters, one of the investment bankers, and was helping to raise money for Keene Demick, and then Keene offered him a job, and that's how he wound up there. So Roger was proposing to me that he and I and TZ put up the money, and that they put up loans in addition, guaranteed loans that are good for 3 years.
Who would put up the guaranteed loans?
Roger, everyone except the founding people.
Right,
the
okay.
People that, we had no money. I think I had $8,000 to my name that I got from EAI, you know, from selling my stock at the time I left. And so I was borrowing money to buy equity.
Okay.
And Roger, TZ, and I put up $75,000 between us, amongst us.
Mm-hmm.
And then we raised another $24,000 from, you know, $1,000 from Starry and Feast, and then, you know, and the lawyers and this and that.
Right.
And John Amy, who was a professor at Purdue. And anyway, we wound up with a total of $99,000 in equity. And then everybody except Mike Story, Bill, and I put up $4 in loan, guaranteed loan, for every dollar of equity. And this was Roger's idea, because it worked at Airgraph,
mm-hmm.
to do it, you know, in other words, basically the three of us would own the company, and most of it. And the plan I had planned on TZ coming in at the end of the second year. I felt we could afford to bring him
mm-hmm.
on board and pay him, and come in as the CEO and general manager, which was, neither Roger nor I coveted that job. And we each saw our own roles somewhat different. And so that was the plan. And so we raised this money. And I might say that the person who had owned Alltech and sold it to Perkin Elmer, Reed Dennis, who became a very, very famous venture capitalist in this area, he wanted to fund me. And I also had, there was only one venture capital firm in the peninsula at that time, and I knew that one of the partners, and then he was willing to, you know, put up $5 million or $10 million, whatever it takes. And you never know, looking back, you know, but I felt that we probably did the right thing. I never had any regrets, even though it was a mistake how we financed it.
Hmm.
Because at the time we started the company, the prime rate was 4%, I think. And we could raise, you know, the interest that we're paying was pretty small.
Mm-hmm.
But within 6 months, I think, and they'd gone to 6%, the prime rate, and went up from there. And,
right.
And so when we could have, if we had raised more equity at the beginning,
uh-huh.
We would have been able to survive, you know, without selling our soul, so to speak, in the subsequent financings.
And so initially you were acting as the general manager?
I was president and general manager.
Right.
And Roger was still working at Syntex, but he was VP of finance for the company. And he and I, and we brought in a person from Alex Cross from Syntex, who was he was the director of the Institute of Steroid Chemistry
mm.
under Jurassic. And we brought in Hal Eyring, Henry B. Eyring Jr. It's a fairly famous name. Hal Eyring is now one of the 12 apostles in the Mormon Church. And yeah, he was at the business school at Stanford at that time, and so we were the board members.
Okay.
And we had the help of John Amy, who was an advisor, father confessor, whatever. He had helped Airgraph through some really, really tough times.
And was Mike's story, was what was his role?
Mike was vice president of engineering.
Okay.
And Bill Feese and Dick Hine were engineers or chemists,
right,
working, and Bill never had any desire for a big title. And he was, I would say he was probably chief scientist from the day he arrived until the day he retired,
right,
without anybody ever wanting to compete or trying. Nobody could compete. But, and so we started up in Stanford Industrial Park.
Okay, that was going to be my next question.
Yeah, we were in the, so we could be near, so Roger could sort of, you know, be down there part of the time without having to travel too far.
Right.
And we found there was a back end of a building, literally a garage, and we rented that, and it was relatively expensive, but in a couple offices.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were in the building on Hanover Street, right down the, across the street from HB and Marion. And we were there for 2.5 years or something like that, until 1970. We moved into a bigger building behind it that they built maybe 2 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And we really couldn't afford that, so we moved to Sunnyvale.
And let me just look through my questions. So from the, once you're in there establishing and really get going, financed in your space, is the number one goal is develop GCMS,
right,
and that's that development effort. What is that, right? That was the number one thing to do because that was going to be the product.
We had two number ones. One number one to get some dollars coming in the door. We built a residual gas analyzer that was different. It was a higher specification unit than what we had done at EAI. And we didn't, we were doing this for a company called Granville Phillips in Boulder, Colorado.
Mm.
And we were building for them to sell. And we had part of the agreement was that we'd teach them how to build them, so they could do it themselves.
Okay.
Something they never took us up on. And we also did that for a company in France that had been selling for us, for EAI, and had they were going to build their own product anyway. And so we made the same agreement with each of them. And I think we got $50,000 up front from each of them for doing this.
Right.
And it was, I'd say we rebuilt the RGA, and it was, we were not really that, I would say, competitive with EAI in the, you know, EAI variant, I guess you'd say. These companies were going to do it with somebody or do their own anyway.
And, right.
And so, but it was a smaller project, and we were out of that business within 2 years. We really didn't pursue it beyond those two, developing that product for Granville Phillips particularly.
And you saw that as the transitional business while you're doing the
development. And the electronics that we put in that product was the electronics we're building for the GCMS.
Okay.
And so it had same mass range and to mass 750 and
mm-hmm.
so on. And so it was really just taking that part of it and selling it separately.
Okay.
Selling the head in the electronics bit. And but really from day one, Mike Story was project engineer for GCMS, our GCMS 1015 that we ultimately called the product, model 1015.
And the 1015, that was introduced, if you were in 68, is that correct?
Actually, in 67, late 67, we prepared a brochure, and it's part of what I'll give you, and in which we introduced this product as a laboratory NAND spectrometer. And we showed, you know, we actually had models, you know, that were made of cardboard or something that we used for the brochure, but the product was not really ready mm-hmm. to show. And we got an order for that product from Stanford genetics department in, I would say, probably the fall of 67
mm-hmm.
to be delivered in 68. And it was delivered on January 1 of 68.
And that was just, did I hear correctly that was just a laboratory analytical mass spec with no GC there?
It didn't have a GC because they wanted to hook it themselves
to their
own GC,
okay.
which they had in their lab. And a lot of people at that time had their own GCs and would ask you to hook it up to that or one like it.
Right.
Made by either HP or Varian.
And that was Lederberg's group who wanted it?
Right.
And yep. Okay.
And they also had, they wanted to computerize it. They wanted to hook it up to the Acme system and to Link 8, which was the predecessor to the PDP-8.
Mm-hmm.
And they had Walt Reynolds was the person doing that project.
Now, did the electronics that you delivered on, their desire to link that instrument into their computer system, did you have to do something with the electronics for the instrument that you delivered to allow for that?
We had to work with them, but we actually had, the quadrupole has a linear mass to voltage ratio. And so that it was a very straightforward thing.
Okay.
We provided output 0 to 10 volts, which was, you know, over a mass range of
mm-hmm.
10 to 500 or something.
Okay.
And so that was straightforward. And they were the ones principally doing that.
Okay.
But we worked with them, and Bill Feast would make sure, you know, that they had a place to grab onto
mm-hmm.
to plug their computer in
mm-hmm.
to both run the mass spectrometer, control it, as well as record data.
The first one that would control it.
Right.
Wow. And then is it at this time that, so at this very early period, you're thinking about the data system dimension, you know, quite obvious,
right.
You just said. There's this early acquisition that you do at Finnegan, which is Disk Instrument.
I'll take a quick break.
Sure.
You need a potty break. More involved, I might say, than I've ever had with anyone since the formation of the company.
Just our review of the details.
It's very detailed.
Yeah. I thank you for indulging me in my love of detail. So with Disk, what's the story?
I might just comment, you brought up one thing, and that's probably very key, and that is that it was my feeling at the very founding of the company that it is essential that, and I must say it probably was based on previous work with Jurassic's people and Walt Reynolds, who was Lederberg's computer guy.
Right.
And that we had to computerize the system. And You know, I mean, that was part of our objective, to find a way as early as possible, feeling that a computerized, that there's too much data. You know, let's say that, our bag was to provide a computerized GCMS, mm-hmm. that it was not very easy to do any other way. The magnetic instruments, namely, had a hard time
right.
doing that. And that we felt was our success was just absolutely tied to that. And we knew it from, it was, you know, our objective from the time of formation of the company. And that didn't happen right away, but it was on our mind. And obviously, our first instrument being computerized immediately sort of, you know, made that something that we saw could be done
right.
and realized the value of. And I spent literally hours and hours every week at Lederberg's lab in genetics with the people there, seeing what they're doing, you know, watching and learning in great detail the value of the computerized system. And so that was really, you know, tops on our list as something we had to do.
Right. And was that part of the motivation behind that early acquisition of DISC?
No.
No.
No, it had nothing to do with it.
No, there was my theory.
Now, we I'd say when we were maybe 68, we became aware that DISC was, the owner of DISC was in late 68 and early 69, that the owner of DISC was wanting to retire and get out of the business. There were digital integrators coming along, and he saw the handwriting in the wall. And so we became aware that, I think TZ was the one who told Roger and I that this might become available. And we were running out of money at a hell of a rate.
Mm-hmm.
And we really realized we needed a cash cow
uh-huh.
to keep the, you know, the doors open. And so we, I don't know how much I want to publicly say, we actually decided, you know, we knew how much he wanted. Warren Prine was the owner of DISC. And it was $1 million that it would take to buy him out. And we didn't have $1 million, but Roger's very shrewd and felt that he could use their assets to raise $1 million if he owned them. And so we actually we asked Alex Zaffaroni to join with Roger and I. We both put in $25,000, I think, and Alex put in $1 million, and we bought them. We took Alex guaranteed a loan with the bank of Wells Fargo, and so we used that money to purchase them, and then immediately turned around and paid off the loan by borrowing money against their assets, and so we now own a profit-making company, and we're able to, you know, to pay off
right.
The loan and relieve Alex Zaffaroni of his obligation, and Wells Fargo were able to get their money back.
Right. And DISC, I'm sorry.
And DISC were making, they were making DISC integrators for GCs, and they're making digital shaft encoders. This was a product that they had that we thought would have longer term benefits.
Mm-hmm.
But it was always run as a separate company. And so that, that gave us a balance sheet that looked better
okay.
Than, you know, it had with Finnegan alone, which was losing money at a pretty
good rate. So basically kept that organization just as it was, and it was just right. an ownership
right.
change.
So. Right, and we brought in, I think, when we brought TZ on board shortly after that in August of 69, it was September 1st. And then in TZ, I can't remember whether we hired a guy named George Jordan who had worked for TZ and Roger worked with them at Airgraph. We put him in charge of it. He was in charge for a number of years. But we ran it as a separate operation the whole time. And you know, it was subsequently sold to Honeywell and for $8 million. And so it was a good investment, and it made profit every year that we had it. Made a good profit.
When was that sale to Honeywell?
I think it was around 80.
Okay, so it was a long,
relatively long.
Okay.
Yeah, it was early 80s.
So I wasn't able to figure that out from by looking around. So you get that in place, and this is right around the time, I guess, that the 1015, I guess at that time it's GCMS.
Sort of.
Oh,